Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. We are live here on Progressive Radio Network today on February 24th, 2015, and we're feeling alive. We're freezing feeling alive, aren't we, here in the, on the East Coast? It's crazy here, and looking forward to some changes. I'm really glad to be here, and I want to shout out to the great staff at Progressive Radio Network. We've been having some challenges and moving, and we're still here. We're still here. I want to bring on my guest today, Ricky Heller, Ph.D., RHN, an award-winning blogger, educator, recipe developer, and the author of Naturally Sweet and Gluten-Free, and associate editor for Simply Gluten-Free magazine. She lives in Ontario, where it's also very cold. And you can find her at rickyheller.com. She's got a new book. We're going to be talking a bit about that, a lot about it, actually, Living Candida Free. Ricky, how are you doing today? Ricky, are you with me? Hello. I don't hear
Ricky. Karen.
Oh, there you are. Is this the frozen tundra delayed response we're getting?
Oh, really?
Yeah, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you? Nice. I'm glad we managed it.
I know, me too. I'm really glad. You just never know with anything. You can never be certain of anything.
Absolutely agreed.
And, you know, that's a good way to live your life. Never expect anything. You'll never be disappointed.
That is true. That is true.
And then you always end up with some fun surprises, like doing this program today, which I wasn't sure was going to happen. But now it's happening, so let's celebrate and make the most of it.
Sounds good.
So tell me, how cold is it in Toronto?
We have broken so many records.
Congratulations.
I beg your pardon?
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you can look at it. See, there you go. It's looking at the positive. I think apparently we just broke a 143-year record, I heard, or something like that, for coldest February. It's the first February where we've never gone above zero, which is above freezing in Celsius. So, like, nothing above 32, I guess, Fahrenheit.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how do you stay light and humorous during this period?
Well, what alternative do you have?
Yeah.
I was just telling someone how I wear I'm getting used to wearing two pairs of pants, four sweaters, two pairs of gloves, a hat with earmuffs on top of it. Like, it's crazy just to walk my dog. It takes me longer to get dressed than we're actually walking.
Oh, I was going to say you wear all that indoors, right? And then you really bundle up when you go out.
Yeah, really.
All right. Let's talk about your latest book and all of your adventures. So we're going to be talking about candida and how to be candida-free. And the first thing I want to say is candida. Do you know the origin of that word? It's such a happy-sounding name. Candida. You know, I can think of all kinds of ways.
You know what? I don't actually. Isn't that hilarious? I do know it's pronounced differently, though, if you're talking to an alternative practitioner or an allopathic practitioner.
Oh, how do we say it?
So we say, in the alternative holistic world, we say candida. But if you're talking to a conventionally trained doctor, they call it candida.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I think that's the Latin term, like candida albicans. Mm. So that may have something to do with it. And I've been corrected in the past because I was pronouncing it wrong. But in fact, every alternative practitioner does call it candida, so even naturopaths. And for some reason, I kind of like that divide because it shows that we're actually talking about something that's slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the alternative world, we're talking about this syndrome that I have been dealing with. But if you're talking to a conventional doctor, what they mean by candida is there's a condition called candidiasis, which is basically a blood infection of this fungus, and it is literally deadly. Like, you need to be treated immediately and aggressively, or you're going to die. So that may also be part of the reason why, over the years, conventional doctors have kind of looked at you askance if you say, I have candida, because they think you'd be dead. So it's a completely different, we're talking about something that begins in the gut and has more to do with an imbalance in the gut, and they're talking about an actual bloodborne disease.
Wow, you say candida, and I say candida.
I like to say blame
candida. Candida, let's call the whole thing off. Well, now that's part of the frustration and the challenge that so many people have who have what we're going to call candida.
Mm-hmm.
Candida. I just want to keep singing. It's such a melodic kind of word. I don't have the same feeling about it as you do, so you probably don't really want to sing about it.
Well, maybe now, not at the beginning for sure.
And as you said, you know, doctors, conventional, traditional doctors, don't even acknowledge its existence, although I want to think that maybe more and more they are, because they're learning from the alternative practitioners.
And I think, yes, I really think the situation is changing. We're sort of in transition now because this whole branch of functional medicine, which is much more prevalent in the U.S. than it is here in Canada, although there are some functional doctors here, but very few and far between. But you have this branch of functional medicine that is now really like an integrative, complementary way of looking at the body and health. And so they're acknowledging candida, and they're also using established scientific methods at the same time. So I think that brings a whole new realm of credibility to this, because if, you know, someone like Mark Hyman or Andrew Weil are looking at this and saying, yeah, it exists, then the rest of the world's going to start to take note too.
All right. So if you have a candida, what are you experiencing?
All kinds of fun things. So, you know, this is one of those conditions where it can actually spread to so many different systems in the body that the symptoms can be far-ranging. And initially what you're going to get are certain symptoms, and then as it gets worse, it will spread to other systems. So initially, if you have really intense sugar cravings that really feel beyond what normal sugar cravings would be, just completely out of control, That's a real tip-off. And also, people often begin with all kinds of digestive distress. So my first symptom, years before I was diagnosed with candida, was IBS. First I was told that I had IBS mm-hmm. because they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And then that can then become candida overgrowth over time, or it might be just a sign that you're starting to have candida overgrowth. And then, because candida is a yeast or fungus, all of these conditions that are connected to fungi, so yeast infections for women, jock itch for men, things like athlete's foot or fungal toenail or fingernail infections. And then what was my major symptom in 2009 when I was diagnosed for the second time was a fungal rash or candida rash, which is, I mean, just looks like a regular rash, except that it's a little bit worse than your average rash because it's really red, really raw, and both itchy and painful at the same time, at least it was for me, but really, really itchy. So that can be, and it spreads like crazy if you don't get it under control. So that is another symptom that a lot of people get. And then from there, if it gets worse and it's not addressed, you know, you might end up with other symptoms. And some people have other symptoms before they get these, but for me, those were the ones that sort of started things off.
I'm sure conventional medicine just wants to throw medication when you have a rash like you experienced.
I put every cream known to humankind on that rash, and I was prescribed every cream known to humankind. I saw 7 dermatologists, and they gave me literally all of the antifungal creams they had, and nothing worked, nothing.
I'm getting the feeling, as we're learning more about the microscopic land in our bodies, and we're learning about bacteria and bugs and all those little tiny things, that it's going to open the door to a lot of good healing for things that have different names but are probably similar in origin and just different in symptoms.
I think that's absolutely true. The more we learn, even like my IBS, right? I mean, certainly IBS is still a diagnosis, but, you know, someone might have connected it more quickly to candida if we knew then sort of what we know now, right? And you hear a lot of talk about leaky gut syndrome and how that's often connected to candida. So the microbiome, or that inner ecology that you were talking about, is so important, and I think we're just beginning to learn how important it is to keep that equilibrium inside our intestinal tract and how so many of us have an imbalance just based on the lifestyle that we've been living, you know, without even doing anything that we would consider abnormal or wrong or extreme. Just the average lifestyle that we live now in North America can contribute to that kind of imbalance. It's crazy.
It's crazy. I just feel like singing today. I don't know what
right,
it is.
It's a great way to keep a good mood in this weather for sure.
Yeah. Stay tuned for more tunes. Now, you do a lot of explaining in the beginning of your book, and that's good, so people have a better feeling about candida and our whole digestive process, and things can really go awry in so many different places in our digestive tract.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, one thing's connected to the next.
Yeah, and I want to just say that chapter one that describes the whole digestive process is actually by my collaborator, Andrea Nakayama, who is a functional nutritionist out of Portland. And so she actually does do the whole science approach. She's one of these people who manages to meld the holistic with the established scientific establishment. And so she, I think, does a brilliant job of really taking that process and making it something really understandable that we can all follow and comprehend in sort of layman's terms. But yeah, it's you know, when you think about it, really, as Andrea says, everything starts in the gut. Like, we have 70% of our immune system is housed in our gut, and all of those little microscopic organisms that you were talking about, like the germs and the parasites and the good bacteria and the bad bacteria and the candida and so on, there are 10 times as many of those organisms as we have cells in our body. So there are 10 times as many of them as there are of us. So you want to keep them happy.
Make friends with your microorganisms.
Yeah, because think about that, you know, that they keep you running smoothly.
I was spinning through this as you were chatting and lost my place. All right. I know what I wanted to ask you. Can you explain what a functional nutritionist is?
Yeah, I mean, here in Canada, we call it holistic nutritionist, and they're very, very similar. So she takes a functional approach. She looks at the function of each organism, each system, and tries to connect that to what might be going wrong. So it is it's a much more holistic, and it's definitely an alternative approach. But she uses the scientific evidence to come to those conclusions. So the way I sort of summarize what she does is she takes a scientific approach to diagnosis and then a holistic approach to treatment for the most part, but it's rooted in the science. So she'll do like a blood analysis, and based on those results, then she will always first attempt to treat with the most natural therapies.
I love that.
Me too. I really do. I wish we had more of that here in Canada.
Mm-hmm. I don't like going to doctors, but I like occasionally getting the diagnosis, getting the data, and then deciding what to do about it.
Exactly. Yeah, and you want someone who knows, you know, knows what will work and who can assess your individual situation, which is what functional medicine does too. Is they take it on a case by case basis. Because I always say one of the things I say in the book too is, you know, it always used to surprise me when, let's say, you know, my husband is 6'1", I'm 5'4". If we both go to the doctor for a sinus infection, we're going to get the same antibiotic in the same dosage for the same amount of time. To me, that never made sense. You know, he's got way more body mass than I do. You would think that they would adjust the dosage accordingly, but they don't. And so what functional medicine does is they really do look at each person individually, and even if you have the same diagnosis, you may end up with a different treatment based on how you ended up with that diagnosis.
I like it because it makes each one of us feel special.
Yeah.
And we should feel special.
Because we are, yes.
Yes, we should all have individual treatment. Yeah. Now, once you have candida, do you always have it?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean, but do you always have the symptoms and always suffer from it? No, absolutely not. You can definitely recover from candida. I've come to believe that it depends very much on the severity of the situation when you begin to treat it and how long you've let it go before you begin to treat it. So, for instance, in my case, I really kind of waited too long to go and get treatment. So it took me much longer the second time around to get to a point where I felt healthy again. And I have to be much more careful than the average person now, having had it and having gone through that, because I could very easily have a relapse if I start eating sugar again or I start drinking too much wine again or whatever like that. So for me personally, it's, I kind of think of it, not, I don't really want to give a negative analogy, but, you know, the way an alcoholic is always an alcoholic, even if they've been sober for the rest of their life. There's definitely something there that could be triggered in my body and in anyone who's had a really severe case for a long time. However, at the same time, if someone has a mild case and they catch it early, you know, I know people who've gone from having candida to being completely clear of it in 3 months, and then they go back to their regular life and they never have to worry about it again. So again, it's case by case, individual, but some people yes, some people no.
And it's probably something we don't really have an clear understanding of. I'm thinking that you've totally changed your microbiome with your diet, and you've got a lot of happy, health-promoting bugs in your gut. But there's probably something we don't understand, and something related to memory. I like to think that not just the brain, but all parts of our body have memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how that's stored and how that's triggered, but stay tuned. We'll find that out in a few days.
And I think part of it is, you know, you can never eradicate all the candida because you're supposed to have some. So it's there. And so if it's ready to kind of spring back into action if you've dealt with an overgrowth before.
Now, what are the really bad foods? What are the things that candida love to thrive on?
Favorite food was my favorite food, too, sugar. Refined sugar, refined flours, refined grains, white potatoes, anything that's easily converted to sugar in the body is the number one food for candida. But in terms of sort of triggers or situations that might cause candida to develop, and candida is the result of something that's already happened, which is an imbalance in the microbiome. So candida itself isn't a disease, but it's the overgrowth of candida that results from that is the problem. So what can cause that overgrowth is anything that creates an imbalance to begin with. So you've probably heard, you know, like antibiotics will wipe out, of course, the bad bacteria that are giving you whatever infection it is, but they will also wipe out the good bacteria that keep that gut in balance. And so a lot of people have learned that they need to take yogurt or probiotics after a course of antibiotics. But really, once that happens, I've read that it will take up to 3 months to replace what you lose from 1 2-week course of antibiotics. So you should be taking probiotics for at least 3 months after every course of antibiotics. But so once those are wiped out, then that's a prime territory for candida. And anything that creates that kind of upset, anything that causes an acidic situation in the body, so, you know, we go between acid and alkaline, and sugar is very acid-forming in the body, as is red meat, as is coffee, as is alcohol, as is, to me, this one was the most surprising, but it does make sense, stress, very acid-forming in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it all kind of comes together when you look back over your, you know, the triggers over the years. I think, oh, I had that, check. So it's almost as if there was no way I wasn't going to end up with candida, given all of those possible triggers.
Now, something I like to say often is that when I restrict food from my diet, all of a sudden the world opens up and I'm eating more varied foods than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you feel about that.
I feel that's exactly what happened to me when I went gluten-free. Because here I was thinking, oh, I can't have gluten anymore. It's going to be so restrictive. And what ended up happening was I found out about, you know, maybe a dozen different gluten-free grains that I never knew before. And I've said this before, I think I said this last time. I love baking more with gluten-free flours now than I did with regular flour because there's so much variety. And depending on your mood even, you know, do I feel like teff today or do I feel like sorghum? So, you know, there's just this vast array of possibilities. And I think that happens to a lot of people. They think they're going to end up being more restricted, but that kind of prompts them to go out and try foods they never would have tried otherwise.
Now, you're encouraging people to find their kitchens with this book and make a lot of things on their own, which is something that I always do because it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, and I want to get into some of these recipes because they're stunning, and I just want to eat every page that I'm looking at right now because I'm hungry. but can people eat the way you're recommending and not make food at home?
Yes, you can, ultimately. At the very beginning, I would say it's probably more important to take the first few weeks and really be sure that you understand the diet and you can make all those things yourself, and also because that's going to help your body to clear out the toxins much faster and clear out the candida much faster. But, you know, I'm at the point now where I'm on what I call the maintenance level of candida diet, and so I go out to a restaurant. My husband, you know, before I met him, I think he lived in an apartment once for 2 years and used the oven once in 2 years. So he's used to eating in restaurants, and he loves to eat in restaurants. So we go out about once a week now. We used to go more when we were first dating. But, you know, I can eat in restaurants, and what happens is you can ease up on some of those restrictions as you continue through the diet. So I don't have a problem now. I can always find something, and then I have my favorite restaurants where I can find many things and you know, have a great variety. But, you know, I'll still go out with friends, and I don't have to ask them to go to a special restaurant for me because I can always find something that's okay within my parameters. At the beginning, you do want to learn, though, how to make a lot of this stuff yourself because you're healing, and you can't eat sugar, and if you read labels, you know that almost everything you buy or everything in a restaurant is going to contain sugar. So you really do have to be careful when you first start out.
Labels. Don't talk to me about labels. Later on in the program, I'm going to talk about my love or unlove or lack of love for labels because, you know, even though we read the labels, there are lies in the labels that we're learning more and more about. It is so frightening, which is another reason why it's so good to make food at home because you have that much more control over what's in your food.
Yeah, as much as you can, I think it's really crucial.
Okay, so you have basics here, and some of these basics are like basics for any cook at home, like making your own stock.
Mm-hmm, sure, yeah, anybody can do that. And it's that recipe that I actually borrowed one of the aspects of that from a Toronto area cookbook author named Noreen Gillitz. She's the first person I saw who threw the whole onion in with the skin in her stock.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives it this beautiful color, and it looks like meat stock or chicken stock, and it tastes, you know, you don't taste anything different, but it's very flavorful, and it works beautifully.
I like
that. And you don't have to peel the onion.
Right. I like if it's organic. And
yeah.
I like,
oh, yeah.
I like it because it makes it easy and tasty. Yeah.
And I'm all about quick and easy when it comes to cooking, as much as I can be.
Okay. Now, you have recipes for coconut milk and coconut butter using just grinding up shredded coconut.
Yes. And, you know, if you've ever bought that delicious raw coconut butter, or I think it's called coconut cream in some companies, it's delicious, but it's ridiculously expensive. So, again, like you were saying, you have more control. It's also much more economical. And literally, if you have a high-speed blender, it will take you less than 2 minutes to make that coconut butter.
I mean, this is crazy. I never realized you could do that. And I love every time I learn one more thing from somebody that I talk to on this program.
Oh,
but
great.
I mean, it's great because so many reasons. There's less packaging. It stays a long time. You can have it whenever you want.
Yep.
And basically, it's the flaked coconut is just the coconut without the water.
Yeah, unsweetened dried coconut. It has to be unsweetened, and it has to be fairly fresh because if it's not, you know, it's dried, but if it's been sitting in the cupboard for 6 months, it gets even drier, and at that point you might have to add like a tablespoon of coconut oil just to moisten it up again.
This is very exciting. Well, everybody loves coconut milk, and it's so good for so many different things.
Oh, yeah, and particularly this diet, because coconut is one of the superstar foods that helps to actually kill the candida in your body.
Now, let's talk about grains.
Okay.
whole grains, are they good? Are they not good?
Yes, whole grains are good. I don't believe in demonizing whole grains. Whole grains contain all kinds of fiber and vitamins and protein, and we need some carbs, and these are complex carbs, and they're good for you. They don't really spike your blood sugar levels. The only thing with the anti-candida diet is you are asked to eat gluten-free whole grains, because so many people have problems with gluten and may not even realize it. And what you're trying to do is limit any foods that would cause irritation to the digestive system. So we keep it at gluten-free grains. And I actually have just stayed on gluten-free grains ever since I started eating them. I've never gone back, even though at this point I could probably go back and have spelt or kamut or something like that. But I love the gluten-free. And why mess with it if it works?
Now, someone, I forget who I was talking to, and I've yet to try it, but making millet flour out of the millet grains, and I was told it was really easy, and I've yet to get around to doing that.
I do that, yeah. Some people use a high-speed blender. I use a coffee grinder, like a spice grinder, and I just put it in, it's a small amount, but if you put in a quarter of a cup of millet, you're going to end up with close to half a cup of flour, and that, for my purposes, like I'll usually use it for pancakes or something like that, that's more than enough for what I need, but you can just do a couple of batches if you need more flour, and the reason why I think that's better is because you are starting with a whole grain that you know is still intact and hasn't been processed except to be dried, whereas with flour, it's often gone through further processing, so...
Mm-hmm.
What's weird for me is I'll sometimes react to millet flour, but I won't react to millet ground up into flour.
Because other things must have gotten mixed into that flour.
Yeah, and even just the processing, they've changed the sort of the chemistry of it, right? It's not identical to just ground up millet anymore.
It's not as fresh either.
Mm-hmm, and it's probably, exactly, it's probably not.
Yeah, so I'm looking at your whole grain waffles where you're using raw or toasted buckwheat groats, uncooked millet, and some other basic waffle ingredients.
Yep. And so you're basically turning that into flour for that recipe. You're grinding them up and turning it into flour, and then, yeah.
Yeah, I like it. Giving me some new ideas.
Oh, good. And lots of desserts, of course, because, I'm a sweets addict, and that's what got me in trouble in the first place. But these are anti-candida desserts that will not feed the yeast.
And that's because for a sweetener, you use stevia.
Yeah, I use stevia, and I use, to a very small extent, actually not in this book. Since the book came out, I've been experimenting with xylitol, which I do quite like. But in the book, it's stevia and some meacone syrup, and in a very few instances, there are a couple of fruits that you're allowed in the second stage of the diet. But I wanted all the recipes as much as possible to be suitable for someone just starting out. So there are only, I think, like three recipes that are stage two, and everything else is suitable no matter where you are in the diet.
So what fruits can you eat in stage two?
You start to introduce what they call non-sweet fruits, which is an odd name, but anyway, things like apples, pears. You can have berries. They're very low glycemic, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, things like that that won't really affect blood sugar to any great extent. And then by the third phase, you can reintroduce almost anything except the very sweet fruits, the ones that they consider the sweetest, like dried fruits are all very sweet, and bananas and mangoes, those kind of really sweet ones. Mm-hmm. But again, like I'm at the point where I can have those every once in a while now.
Yay.
Again. Yeah,
that's good.
I love them.
I'm going to rant here a minute. I'm looking at your hummus recipe, and I was on Facebook the other day, and I saw a sponsored post by Sabra. And it had like 20,000 gazillion likes and all these people talking about their hummus. And I was steaming because have you ever read the ingredients on Sabra hummus?
A long time ago. I don't know.
Okay. Number one, it's not organic, so boo.
Right.
But number two, other than potassium sorbate, which is a preservative that I don't feel like eating, they use soybean oil.
Oh, my God. I bet they've changed their recipe.
Yeah, and they call it traditional or classic, and there's nothing classic about it because hummus, which came from Turkey in the Middle East, where they have a lot of olive oil and not soybean oil, hummus doesn't have soybean oil in it.
Right.
and you know it's genetically modified.
Oh yeah, that's bad. I think when they first started out, I believe that they started out in, I could be wrong if they're a Canadian company, but when they were really small and just starting out, I think, as I recall, their ingredient list was slightly different, because I don't remember those being in it.
They probably got bought by somebody else.
Mine's not traditional either, is it?
No, but yours looks good. Yeah, we've done a lot of variations on hummus since, so yours has almond butter in it.
Yeah.
And because, you know, we don't really need to have a lot of oil, and it's good to have foods that have fiber in them. Fat mm-hmm. with fiber, right?
Yeah. I find it helps. It makes it creamy.
Yeah. But you also include the tahini,
mm-hmm.
which is an important flavor in traditional hummus.
Right.
Yeah. I don't use olive oil in my hummus either, although I love olive oil, and I could drink it up, but I don't.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Good plan.
Yeah. And right next to it is a nice raw almond veggie pate.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
My favorites, too, yeah.
Yeah.
And these are all pretty easy to make for people who may not be used to cooking a lot. I mean, the veggie pate, you soak your almonds, rinse them, you throw everything in the food processor, you're done.
Now, another one that I just wanted to mention is, and I rarely see this. I mean, I do it, but I rarely see it. And you've got this garlicky, warm avocado sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And I love when avocado is warm.
Mm-hmm. I do in sauces like that. And I also sometimes use it in baking as an egg substitute, actually. But I think, you know, you make a lovely sauce and toss your pasta with it. I think it's delicious that way. And cold. I just like it every which way.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, but I find that there's a different flavor somehow that's brought out when it's warm.
Yeah, I agree. I think
really.
It's like having a whole different food.
All right, so we're pretty much at the end, and I just wanted to ask you if you have some wise words, in addition to buying your book, what people who think they have candida should be doing right now?
Well, the first thing you want to do is cut out refined sugar from your diet, and I would suggest seeking, you know, speak to a holistic nutritionist or functional nutritionist or a naturopath, I think you call it naturopath in the States, someone who can assess your symptoms. There are online questionnaires you can take that will help to assess your symptoms, so use that and see how your score comes out. But if you do suspect, I mean, you want to be working with someone who's dealt with candida before and can help you work through the diet and knows which supplements you would need to take. So I would say seek out some professional help.
Okay. Well, you know, I think whether you have candida or not, the recipes in this book are, they look delicious, and they're health-promoting.
Yep.
And just like I was saying before, there are many different ailments and diseases, I think, that have different symptoms, but probably the same original causes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking when I was going through advanced ovarian cancer about 8 years ago, I stayed away from sugar. And I was curious what you called the sweet fruits, because I was eating berries, but I really stayed away from anything that could feed those bad cancer cells.
Mm-hmm.
And this book would probably help anyone going through that sort of crisis as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, one of the more recent theories about cancer is that it is a fungus. So if that's the case, then this is the ideal diet. You want a sugar-free diet for sure, and a diet that's very alkalizing and high in vegetables, absolutely.
Oh, great. Well, then maybe in a few years you could repackage the book with a different name. And
I'll call it, publisher about that, for sure.
Call it the anti-cancer diet or something like that. Oh, okay. Or maybe something, well, anyway, it's good. Just the way it is. Ricky, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. Stay warm.
You too. Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you again.
Okay. Nice talking with you. Whew. There you go. That was Ricky Heller, Living Candida Free, and you can find her at rickyheller.com. Let's move on. I wanted to talk about a number of different things. And let's see. I was just talking about genetically engineered foods, right, with the soybean oil. And you can never be careful enough, if you care, And I have a feeling you care, because you wouldn't be listening if you didn't care about food. And I'm glad that you care. But just like the hummus that I was mentioning, do you read the labels on your hummus? Soybean oil, if it's not organic, it's going to be genetically modified, and you don't want that in your hummus. You don't want that in anything that you eat. But on the subject of genetically engineered foods, a couple things I wanted to mention is the newest foods that have been included in the approved foods for consumption, and that is we now have two approved varieties of genetically engineered apples. Thank you, USDA. And what's interesting is these apples that are genetically modified have been created by a small company. This isn't from the Monsanto or the Syngenta monsters. This is from a small biotech company called Okanagan Specialty Fruits, and actually they're in British Columbia, Canada. I should have mentioned that to Ricky before I let her go. Thank you, Canada. Now, what really bugs me about these apples is they have been designed to be non-browning. So you know when you bite into an apple and then you leave the apple on the table, or if you cut an apple into slices and you just leave it there, they brown. Okay, so that might be a little unpleasant. The point, I think there are some easy solutions. One, if you're eating an apple, eat the whole apple and don't let it brown like that. It's problematic for stores and restaurants that want to cut the apples ahead of time and then have them out on display and not brown, because then people won't want to eat them. And I think it's more about money, having a food last as long as it can before you sell it, have it out on display as long as you can until it's sold, and have it look fresh, whether it is or not. Now, one of the secret tricks for anybody who slices apples for a party or something, who knows what the trick is? It's so simple. Lemon juice. You sprinkle some lemon juice on the apple, it is not going to brown or not brown as quickly. It's a simple solution, and it's also delicious. It gives the apple a nice extra tartness, and it's wonderful. Do we really need genetically engineered apples? I'm pulling my hair out here. Of course, there's never enough safety testing on any of these foods that are let out for public consumption to know if they are going to have any impact on our health or the health of other living beings around us, plants and animals. We just don't know. We're one big lab experiment. And so what can you do? The only thing we can do at this point is buy organic. And I really want to have faith in organic foods. You can't really have 100% faith in anything these days, unfortunately, but this is the best way. Buy organic and don't buy these particular apples called Arctic Granny and Arctic Golden apples. And just because I'm singing a lot today, I have to do this. I'm thinking of Joni Mitchell, who was very, very prescient when she wrote Big Yellow Taxi. Can we do... Can we just do a quick little verse, one verse, the one in the middle? Hey, farmer, farmer, put away that DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, but leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise and put up a parking lot. Whew! Yeah, I hear that all the time when I'm reading things like genetically engineered apples. I want spots on my apples, please. Now, a little good news, quasi-good news, is that a bill that would require Labeling of foods with genetically engineered ingredients, what a concept, is called the Genetically Engineered Food Right to Know Act, has been introduced in Congress, our very heavily Republican Congress, and surprise, it was introduced by a bunch of Democrats, Barbara Boxer, Richard Blumenthal, and Peter DeFazio. They're the lead sponsors of the bill, and it was similar to one that they introduced in 2013, but wasn't voted on by Congress. I want to think this is great news. I don't know how it's going to get through Congress and get approved, but apparently 93% of Americans want to know if their food has been genetically modified. So if our elected officials were listening to their constituencies, they'd know we want labeling. We want labeling. And labeling, as I mentioned before, isn't even enough. If you remember, a few weeks ago, I interviewed Peter Laufer, who wrote the book Truth Behind Food Labeling, and we learned with him, you probably knew all of this already, but we learned that even information on labels today may not be telling us the whole picture or may not be entirely true, as he found out from where the foods he was buying were coming from. He got some rancid walnuts from Trader Joe that said they were from Kazakhstan, I think, and then he went all the way to Bolivia to see if some organic beans he bought were truly from this place in Bolivia and were truly organic. The good news is he did confirm all of that. He didn't really confirm anything about those rancid walnuts. But there's so many things that we're finding out about labeling that give me pause, give me a little concern. Right now, if you're familiar with the recent programs we're doing at Responsible Eating and Living, we've created a webisode called Real Good News in Review, and we have produced two episodes. If you don't know about them, if you haven't watched them, please spin over to responsibleeatingandliving.com and check them out. They're three-part series. The first part is a newscast, the second part is a food show, and the third part is a feature of a local business who's promoting something that we think is good to talk about. And in the next episode, which should be coming out in a week or so, I'll be talking about chocolate. And I don't want to give it all away, but I've been researching a lot about chocolate, and once again, labeling is not enough. For example, the FDA just tested 100 non-dairy dark chocolates. And what did they find out? Many contained dairy. It's just like, whoa, what? Now, for some of us, it's not that big a deal. I know a lot of vegans, for example, we understand that there are some small vegan chocolate companies. They don't have their own equipment. They have to rent equipment or borrow it, and so they wash the equipment thoroughly, and they have to put on their label that there may be a little dairy in it just because they're using the equipment. Well, this can really be devastating to people who are allergic to dairy, and for those of us that really don't want to participate in any kind of business or exploitation that has anything to do with dairy. So it's very disconcerting to find out that you're not getting what you think you're getting. And we need a lot more transparency, and unfortunately, we need a lot more testing because we can't trust anybody. You probably heard this a few years ago, and maybe you did, maybe you didn't, and that's why I'm bringing up some of these things, because there oftentimes there are food headlines. People hear about them, especially those of us who are passionate about food. We hear about things, and we get the alerts, and we jump on them, and we read about them, and we become knowledgeable. But many people miss the headlines for one reason or another. Maybe they didn't watch the news or read the paper or look online, or they were busy, or they were involved in something else, whatever. But things that seem really important at the time, we stop talking about them and go on to the next headline, and people will miss things. An example of this is when it comes to fat and oils. A couple of years ago, there was a book that came out about olive oil, talking about how there are some, that it was discovered that some olive oils, let's say pure olive oil or 100% olive oil or whatever they say olive oil contains olive oil, have other cheaper oils mixed in with them. And how do you find out about that? Well, people have to do testing to find out. And we want to trust. We want to trust that the food that we buy is what it says it is. And it's a challenge. So I'm grateful for those people out there doing the hard work. But I think it's important to bring these things up again. News isn't always new. So sometimes it's just important to keep bringing these things up so we don't forget about them and we do something about them, right? So olive oil isn't always all olive oil. Rice, we've talked about rice. Rice can have arsenic in it. And there are so many different things related to that. And now chocolate, dark chocolate that should be dairy-free has dairy in it. It also has cadmium and lead sometimes. It's crazy. Whew. Well, now, let's talk a little bit about our government and dietary guidelines. Now, this, I think overall this is good news, and I want to tell you what some of the new good news is. But you may have heard that the 2015 dietary guidelines are now available. And if you have the time and the inclination, go to health.gov/dietary guidelines, and you can download them, and you can comment on them. Now, it's a mouthful. The guidelines are over 500 pages, and I have not had a chance to go through them. I did read the executive summary, and I'm going to point out some of the things that I'm kind of happy about and maybe not so happy about. And individuals are encouraged to submit written comments, and they'll be accepted online before April 8th. So here's an opportunity for all of us to have our say. And the more of us that make comments, the better. Now, the first thing I want to say about our government's dietary guidelines, I'm not going to the government to find out what's best in terms of healthy diets. It seems like our government is at least a decade or more behind the best knowledge of nutrition. This is not the place to go for nutritional excellent information. But unfortunately, a lot of regulations are based on these dietary guidelines, which affect everyone. They affect schools and all kinds of government institutions. And a lot of people use these guidelines to know what it is they should be eating. So here's some of the good news. First, they recognized a couple of realities that we're sick and we're fat. Half of all American adults, 117 million individuals, have one or more preventable chronic diseases, and about two-thirds of U.S. adults, nearly 155 million individuals, are overweight or obese. So that's the starting point. And now what do we do about that? Well, there are lots of things, and I'm really excited about some of the things that they've mentioned. Now, they notice that there are some nutrients that are underconsumed relative to the average requirement or adequate intake level set by the Institute of Medicine. And these are vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, vitamin C, folate, calcium, magnesium, fiber, and potassium. And right away when I see these nutrients, I think plant foods. Eat plant foods, you're going to get your vitamin A, your vitamin E, your vitamin C, folate, calcium, magnesium, fiber, and potassium. What you're not going to get, unless you supplement, and unless you're getting a lot of sun, which we are not here in the East Coast right now in this miserable freezing weather, is vitamin D. You have to supplement vitamin D. And so I'm like reading through the lines here, seeing the nutrients that are lacking are the ones that are found in plants. Now, the good news is these people figured this out all by themselves. The Dietary Guidelines Committee is huge. They have lots and lots of people working on this, analyzing data, lots of nutritionists, lots of specialists. And it's kind of exciting what they've discovered. They say that the majority of the U.S. population has low intakes of key food groups that are important sources of the shortfall nutrients, including vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and dairy. dairy. I'm mumbling the one word I don't like, dairy. But okay. Furthermore, population intake is too high for refined grains and added sugar, right? Okay, we know this. And how refreshing it is to see a government publication acknowledging these things. And they're trying to figure out what to do about it. And they want a better understanding. And they say here, analysis of data on food categories such as burgers, sandwiches, mixed dishes, desserts, beverages show that the composition of many of these items could be improved so as to increase population intake of vegetables, whole grains, and other underconsumed food groups. How nice is that? Now, it's not like they're telling people to eliminate the foods that I don't like entirely, but they do talk about reducing meat consumption. Hallelujah. And, I highlighted this one in extra colors because I thought it was so exciting. On page 4 of the executive summary, listen to this one. Vegetables and fruits are the only characteristics of the diet that were consistently identified in every conclusion statement across the health outcomes. They're saying that they examined all kinds of studies, and it said that the overall body of evidence said that a healthy dietary pattern is higher in vegetables, fruits, whole grains, low or non-fat dairy, seafood, legumes, nuts, moderate in alcohol, low in red and processed meat, low in sugar, sweetened foods and drinks and refined grains, but vegetables and fruits are the only characteristics of the diet that were consistently identified in every conclusion statement. Every conclusion statement, vegetables and fruits. And whole grains are good, but slightly less consistently compared to vegetables and fruits. Vegetables and fruits in this report are the king and queen, the winners, the most health-promoting foods. And I'm, like, so excited about that. finishing up here on this dietary guideline, 2015 dietary guideline, again, the major findings regarding sustainable diets. Now, this is exciting because now they're including the impact of the environment, sustainability. And a lot of people are annoyed about this. Conservatives are trying to tell us there's no link between nutrition and the environment, and we shouldn't be talking about it. But I don't know where they get their food, but most of mine, all of mine, comes from the ground, which is in the environment. The major findings, the report says, regarding sustainable diets, were that a diet higher in plant foods, such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in calories, animal foods, is more health-promoting and is associated with less environmental impact than is the current U.S. diet. Do you believe this? I'm reading a U.S. government document, and I can't believe that this information, which is not new, but it's something that is finally acknowledged, finally! We're making a difference. We're making headway. It's slow, but it's right here in the dietary guidelines. And then the next sentence, I can't believe. This pattern of eating can be achieved through a variety of dietary patterns, including the healthy U.S. style pattern, the healthy Mediterranean style pattern, and the healthy vegetarian pattern. Vegetarian, that word, is sitting in a government document about how to eat healthfully. Wow, that's the U.S. Dietary Guidelines. I just wanted to end this executive summary because I think it's nice what they say. It will take concerted, bold action on the part of individuals, families, communities, industry, and government to achieve and maintain the healthy diet patterns and the levels of physical activity needed to promote health of the U.S. population. These actions will require a paradigm shift to an environment in which the population health is a national priority and where individuals and organizations, private businesses, and communities work together to achieve a population-wide culture of health in which healthy lifestyle choices are easy, accessible, affordable, and normative, both at home and away from home. Gosh, that's what we do at Responsible Eating and Living, right? Yeah, and now it's very exciting to see that. Now, of course, to have our government put a lot of that into action is something else, but stay tuned. We will see where that goes. Very exciting. So if you can get over to that website and maybe make some comments, I think the government would appreciate that. I would. Let me know if you do that. You can send me an email at info@realneils.org. I always love hearing from you. Okay, so we talked about genetically modified apples and the dietary guidelines, a little bit about oil and chocolate. I love food. Oh, speaking of food, I have a new blog, and it's 2 weeks old today. It's called What Vegans Eat, and I blog every day about what I've eaten the day before. Many of the foods that I list, I have recipes for, and I'm quite surprised because people are liking it. And, you know, we always look for ways to share our information and never know what's going to appeal to people. Well, people are liking it, and I'm very happy about that. So I'm going to continue, and you can find out more about it at responsibleeatingandliving.com. We're also on Facebook. We're also on Instagram. We're also on Twitter and Pinterest. Anywhere where you like to live, you can find great suggestions about healthy food and know what I'm eating. Because people always say, but what do you eat? And now you'll know, right? Well, I think we're done. Is that it? Am I out of time? Here we are. It's the end of the program, and I've really enjoyed it. And I had a chance to talk about some of the things that have been pressing to me about food. Thank you so much for listening. Visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. Please talk to me at info@realmeals.org. And remember to have a very delicious week. Bye-bye.